Dit is SBS Dutch. Op sbs.com.au/dutch staan nog meer interessante verhalen.
First of all, Edie, who is your mob and where are you from?
My cultural group is Badi Jawi people. Now, we're Badi Jawi people, are saltwater people, and we're about 200 kilometres north of Broome on an area called Dampier Peninsula. So we're from the Badi Jawi area, and Badi is more the land and Jawi is more the sea, because we're saltwater people and we also take in the sea and oceans and tides and things like that. So on my father's side, that's where I'm from. But on my mother's side, we come from Queensland, and we're still exploring our Queensland family over there. My mother's father, or my mother's parents, were sent from a place on the west side of Cape York in the north of Queensland. There's a mission called Mapoon Mission, and they were sent across to the Kimberley to a mission there that was run by Presbyterians in a place called Kanmanya.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very isolated area in the Kimberley, the North Kimberley coastline. But they were the Presbyterians, because at the time a lot of missions were being set up in the Kimberley and elsewhere. But early 1900s, the Presbyterians set up a mission there in the heart of the Woodora, Ngarrindjin and Wunnumbal people. And it was all part of that push across Australia to start to anglicise and connect with First Nations people.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a book about this, right? Full Circle.
Yes, I wrote Full Circle about that.
Yeah.
And my grandfather's job was to, he was the sailor of the lugger, the mission lugger that would go from Kanmanya and head south to Broome and call into a lot of the missions and places along the way, and pick up their mail and then come to Broome, resupply, get groceries, building materials, cargo, mail, and then he'd turn around after he'd resupplied and then head back to Kanmanya Mission. And all the way along the coast, he'd be stopping wherever there was a white settlement and dropping off their mail and things like that. Now, he did that from about 1928 right through till when Broome was attacked by the Japanese up until 1942. So that was his job. He was the mission lugger operator, skipper. So that was his job. And then when the war came along, it short-circuited, and he found he was on the run with him and his five children heading south, because by then my grandmother had died up in Kanmanya, so he was left to raise my mother and her five siblings. So they headed south.
Yeah.
So that's, we're still reconnecting with our Queensland family constantly too as well. So we've got a bit of Torres Strait Islander there on my mother's side.
Yeah. I already hear a lot of inspiration to write books in your family history.
Yes.
First of all, before we talk about one of the books, you had a long and successful career in education, actually, and with a focus on improving education outcomes for Aboriginal children and their families. What were the biggest challenges you faced?
Look, I worked in two sectors. It was actually the Catholic that gave me the opportunity to do my teaching degree. And they were very inspirational at the time, the Catholic schools and the Catholic head office. So I did my training through them, teacher training, and then I moved over to the education department. For First Nations kids, for Aboriginal kids, I use the word Aboriginal because that tends to be the population in the Kimberley, Aboriginal people.
Mm.
Certainly they're Torres Strait Islanders, but Aboriginal are the TOs of that area. But the challenges for Aboriginal kids are very complex. And you've got a range of challenges, such as the first obvious challenge is they come from a second or possibly third or may even be fourth language. English is their third or fourth language. So they come to school with this highly sophisticated linguistic wiring in their brain, and yet we teach English. And then so you have to modify and teach English to them as a second language. So that's a huge challenge, because teachers, primary school teachers in WA, and I'd say, dare say, across Australia, aren't taught to teach English as a second language. It's a specialist area you go into. So you've got English as a second language. And, of course, if English is your second language, you come from a different culture that has different protocols. So these kids, when they come to school, they come with a different worldview to you and I. You know, for example, they come with very mature child-rearing practices. So they don't necessarily put up their hand and say, please can I go to the toilet, or please can I have a drink. They just take themselves off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course, what does the teacher do if they're not familiar with that? They see that as highly disobedient behaviour. So you've got all these cultural stuff happening in the classroom in terms of the teachers need to know about. And then the other thing, one of the other important things is their health. In the Kimberley, a lot of Aboriginal kids come to school and they have what they call otitis media, which is a discharged ear. So they can't hear as clearly. They have this, what we call intermittent hearing loss. So you can have a class, say your average class in a remote community school is 15 children, then you can have something like 10 of those kids will have this intermittent hearing loss. So if you're not set up to cater for that, it's no good having the best teacher if they can't hear the curriculum or hear the teaching.
No.
So then you equip the rooms, you soundproof the rooms, number one, and there are ways of doing it where you soundproof the rooms, you put up speakers and the teacher wears a microphone and you amplify the sound.
Yeah.
You also can do a special, like a physio type exercise, which is about postural drainage. We call it the breathe, blow and cough, where you teach them to clear their airways and their where all that ear, nose and throat is all connected. So there are things you can do in your sphere of influence too as well. So if you said to me, you know, they're the main things that you can deal with. And there are programs you can put in your school. Like at the school I was principal at, on the edge of the desert at a place called Wakajonka, you know, we had the elders come in and they were teaching their traditional language. So we were keeping that alive in the school. I had the parents involved with things like a partnership, a compact. This is what the school is responsible for. This is what the community is responsible for. And, you know, you'd involve them. You'd involve them in your school parent association. You'd involve them with organising hunting trips so kids can still connect with their culture and go on country. So it was valuing and recognising that one day I was going to move on, teachers are going to move on, yet the parents are here, so they need to be involved in the sort of education they want with their kids.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it sounds like a very busy job. So when
it's very hard. It's not easy. It's very challenging. It's not like you're dealing with a child that comes to school and has forgotten their reading book and things like that. Because a lot of these kids also have early life trauma that's linked to that intergeneration trauma. So you're dealing with children who are very difficult. They find difficulty to regulate. So
does that make your work extra rewarding?
Oh, yeah, yeah, certainly. Certainly it makes your work, you know, you feel really as though you're making inroads. And the other thing we had is we had a nutrition program. The kids came to school, we'd feed them, they'd change into a school uniform, and then we'd have lunch for them too as well. You know, parents paid, but, you know, we'd provide it. So you're taking away all these challenges for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, they're things, it's very challenging. But if a teacher can go and teach on a remote community school or a school where there's a high percentage of Aboriginal kids and do well, then they can go back into what, you know, a mainstream school and they can cut it. You know, they do very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it is very rewarding.
Yeah. You're now retired and you're writing. When did you start writing books?
I was actually interested in writing back in the mid-80s. I did an assignment, family history, on my French, because I've also got French in me. My maiden name was D'Antoine.
Mm.
On my French great-grandfather came over. So that sparked an interest. There was an interest there to want to know more. But what made me fascinated was my maternal grandfather. When he retired and came and lived with my mother, he had a lot of visitors. He had a lot of visitors, and he'd tell them his story of Kanmunya, of being the mission lugger operator. And they said, "Elf, that would make a fantastic book." And it got me thinking then, you know, here I have all the primary material here in my grandfather to write a book on his, and that's what prompted Full Circle. But sadly, he'd passed. And then I was lucky to interview my mother and get a lot of information from her. But I just knew that we had, my family in itself had amazing stories that needed to be captured. So that prompted me with Full Circle.
Mm-hmm. So it's fair to come to the conclusion that your Aboriginal culture is a big influence to your writing.
Oh, definitely. And the story of Uncle Charlie was always in our family. We knew it as kids growing up. My father told us about it. My auntie told us about it. All my cousins knew about Uncle Charlie and his brave efforts.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about what he did?
Okay. So Uncle Charlie's job in 1942 was to, because the Dutch were evacuated, as you know, from Indonesia, and they were being evacuated, and a lot were coming to Australia and then going over, using Broome as a gateway, then going south to Perth or east to Melbourne or Sydney or the eastern states.
Mm.
But when they flew into Broome, they resupplied and then they flew on. And my uncle Charlie's job was to, he went out, he cleaned the boats. His job was to clean the flying boats. And then he waited for the bigger boat to come in with the fuel, and they'd refuel the boats, and then they'd continue their journey on to either Perth or to Melbourne or Sydney.
Hmm.
So when he was cleaning the boats, his other partner came in a little dinghy, dropped him on the boat and took off in the dinghy. So he was here cleaning the boat. And he was quite happy doing that. And then he saw the Japanese Mitsubishi, or he heard them coming, you know, approaching the bay. Because in the bay there were about 15 flying boats. There was a combination of Dorniers and Catalinas, and they were in the bay, in Roebuck Bay. Now, what happens in Roebuck Bay is the tide. The tide's a huge influence, because the tide was going out, and that meant that they couldn't get any big boats in because the tide was going right out. So he heard the Japanese Mitsubishis fly over, and he thought they were the Allies. He didn't think anything of it, because the whole town of Broome then were caught totally unaware. They were caught totally unaware, the whole town.
Hmm.
So he thought, I better go out and have a look. And then when he saw the Japanese Mitsubishis, he knew that they were going to be attacked. And sure enough, they started attacking the Catalinas and the flying boats. And when he went out, it was just absolute carnage. Your flying boats were alight. People were jumping in the water. It was just carnage. He couldn't believe it. And he knew that if he didn't jump off his boat, you know, that would explode too.
Yeah. And you wouldn't jump in the water for fun, because there were crocs as well.
Not so much the crocodiles. He was worried more about the sharks, he told my father.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, the water was alight, there was billowing smoke, you know, planes were all on fire and things like that. So, and people screaming and yelling in the water. So he jumped in, and there was a Dutch lady and her child. And the Dutch lady couldn't speak English, and Uncle Charlie couldn't speak Dutch.
No.
But they managed through sign language. He managed to show her, hang on to my back and hold your baby tightly, and hang on and I'll take you ashore. So, and he was swimming along, and there was another little girl. She was about 5 or 6. I don't know the exact age. But she was just in the water. She was in the water. She knew a little. She clearly knew a little bit about swimming. So he picked her up and he put her on his back. And as he was swimming along, he was trying to tell them. He said to them, I have to go underwater. We have to duck to avoid the bullets.
Yeah.
So that's what they had to do. When he could see that they were in danger, he would somehow signal to them and they'd go underwater, then come back up again. He got them ashore and he was just exhausted, because you're working against the tide too as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no one else out there, because no one couldn't get out in any boats, because it was in very shallow water. And it was after the whole attack. Because attack took about 20 minutes. It was about 9:30 in the morning, and it took about 20 minutes, was over. And they had to wait a while for the bigger boat to get in to start rescuing people into the bay.
Mm. Yeah. It's an amazing story. You just mentioned that you've heard this story from a young age, told by your grandfather. Did your late Uncle Charlie talk about it himself?
Oh, he talked about it, especially to my brother. My father. But it was my father who kept the story really alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was my father who was, you know, wanted some acknowledgement from the Australian government for the heroic effort of Uncle Charlie. It was my father who pushed it. But I found out later that I always thought it was a woman and her child, but there was this other little girl who was alive today. Back in the Netherlands, she's alive today. It was actually a mother and a child and this other little girl. There was 2 children and a woman he saved. So, wow, that was a very poignant moment for me.
Are you planning to find out if you can meet up with this lady in the Netherlands?
Look, I would dearly love to. I would dearly love to. But the really interesting thing was, it was the Dutch who wanted Uncle Charlie, not the Australian government.
Yeah, because in 1945 he received a medal of humane actions from the Dutch government.
He received more than one. He received about 4 from the Dutch government. He received a letter from Queen Wilhelmina, I think.
Yeah.
Inviting him over there. And he received a certificate of honour from the Humane Society. But he never, to this day, that I know of, he never got any recognition from the Australian government.
Hmm.
So it was you people. It was the Dutch who honoured him and recognised him for what he did.
And was it important to him and to your community, that recognition?
No, it wasn't really. I wouldn't say it was important to my father. It was my father who really wanted some acknowledgement for what Uncle Charlie did. But it was a sign of the times too, Pauline, because there was a piece published in the paper not long after, the West Australian newspaper, saying, I can't remember the exact wording, but Uncle Charlie should be recognised because he did what a white man would do, sort of thing. And it was very telling of the way Aboriginal were treated in 1942.
Yes, I have this article here in front of me, and someone in the paper, Mr. O'Neill, Inspector of Native Affairs in Broome, he says, "I think he should certainly receive some recognition. He is just a lad, and although he has a coloured skin, he has proved his right to be known as a white man." That is just insane, these words.
Yeah. Because it wasn't until well after the war that Uncle Charlie actually applied, because you had to apply to the authorities to get what they call a citizenship rights, where you could access schools, you could access hospitals, you were employable, things like that. So it wasn't until well after the war that he got this citizenship rights certificate, so that he'd have opportunities for himself in life, him and his family.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was indicative of the way Aboriginal or First Nations people were treated at the time. Yeah.
That sentence makes it so clear. I cannot imagine them writing that.
Yeah. But that story was always in our family, and I always knew that it would. I had a sense, gee, this will make a good book. And I actually wrote it during COVID, because I was in Melbourne, in Victoria during COVID. I was in Victoria. I just out of Geelong. And so I thought, you know, now is the time to write it. And so I wrote Charlie Swim during COVID, and I wanted it published in time for the 80-year anniversary in
of the attacks.
Of the attack in Broome.
And it's a children's book.
Well, yes, it is. It's sections of it in Full Circle, in my mother's book. But I wrote kids' book because kids are curious. Children want to know more. You know, children will now grow up with that story. Mm. You know, in schools, when children read this book, they'll go home to their mum and dad, to their parents, or could be grandparents, and of course the first thing they say is, "What did you do at school today?" And the child can say, "I read this magnificent story about a man called Charlie Danpuan who saved a Dutch woman and her child when Broome was attacked in 1942," and their parents probably
don't know about this.
"Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Australia was attacked." So you start to set off a series of inquiries that's brought home by a child who was lucky to read Charlie Swim. So, you know, and then parents start unearthing it. "Oh, gee, Broome was attacked. Oh, wow. There were 88 people killed in that single one attack when the Japanese came over on the 3rd of March, 1942. So it starts to reel in people's mind. "Well, maybe as an Australian, I need to find out more." So that's why the kids' book, I wrote it.
You educate the parents through the kids.
Yes. They're connectors. Children are connectors.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this interview.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Like, deel, geef je reactie. Volg SBS Dutch op Facebook.